ships on the sea. We built the steam engines to sail that wide prairie and charted our course with a lifeline of steel.
That gets you thinking about the outdoors, doesn't it? That wonderful voice and music comes from our guest today, Lisa Johnson. Lisa is the Dane County Horticulture Agent, Extension Agent, and she's with us today to talk about the garden. We're going to zero in a little bit on jumping worms to start out, but of course we'll take other questions from you as we move along, and I hope you'll join in at 800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Lisa, you must get a lot of compliments on that CD.
Oh, thank you. That's very kind of you. It was a lot of fun.
And it's titled?
The Season.
The Season. Yeah. I knew that. And it's available?
At CD Baby, Spotify, iTunes, lots of places. And I'm now working on a second one.
And there's some other gardening songs in there.
Yeah. Yeah, the title song is actually dedicated to the master gardeners that I have been privileged to work with for the last, since 2003.
it's a wonderful CD, and thank you for doing it. Thinking about master gardeners here, there's probably some of them that are getting to be very educated in terms of jumping worms.
Yes, indeed. I have a few of them that I work with that are kind of doing their own experiments in terms of trying to figure out how to control the beasties and, trying to garden around them. If you use certain kinds of plants, you're more likely to have problems than other kinds of plants. So it's really good to have the master gardeners helping out with that.
And they're pretty easy to identify once you see one because, man, yeah. They're moving.
Yeah, they certainly are. Every time I show one to somebody, they're always surprised that they are so active.
How did they wind up in the U.S.?
Well, we're not exactly sure, but they have been in other states a lot longer than Wisconsin. They've been down south. They've been in Kentucky. They've been up in the northeast states. And we got them here, I think you said 2013. I found them in my yard in, I believe, 2014. I was quite distraught about that. But they do travel quite nicely in compost, in plants from plant sales. They really like to hang out in dead leaves. So if you collect dead leaves off the curb, you're likely to end up with a few of them as well. And they can travel in mulch.
And we get a lot from the south, for example, don't we, here in Wisconsin?
Yeah, we're not exactly sure how it got here, but probably infested plant material is our guess.
They're different. I mean, they do different things to the soil than, say, a regular earthworm that we're...
Well, and even the so-called regular earthworms,
They're not native either.
They're not native either. Yeah, they're European, and they have the worst effect on forest soils because they eat the organic matter, and that has...
The regular earthworms.
Yeah, regular earthworms. The jumping worms do that, but at a different... quantum scale. Yeah, exactly. And they really can do a number on your soil. They make it into these little hard granules that kind of represent or kind of look like grains of coffee, except they're a little bit bigger. And when you pick up that soil, it stays in those little clumps. It doesn't reclump. And so if you're trying to, for example, grow seeds in that soil, you don't get good seed to soil contact. And a lot of our more shallow rooted plants have problems growing in those kinds of environments. And we're particularly concerned about forest soils because of the regeneration through seeds. And if we don't get that, then
we got a problem. And if you're, a gardener, or and you're just looking in your own backyard, are they fairly easy to quickly identify, I would think?
Well, not in the spring. They're an annual species, so they overwinter as a cocoon. And when they're very small, they look very much like any other earthworm. I have to, if somebody brings one in at that time of year, I have to put it under the microscope and look at the bristle pattern on their segments, and then I can identify it. But once they develop that clitellum, the band that goes around them that indicates that they're sexually mature, they're pretty easy to identify because their clitellum is white and smooth as opposed to ridged and pink and raised like a European species.
And they'll be moving a heck of a lot faster than the
Oh, yeah. They move in a serpentine fashion. They jump. They thrash around. They'll even shed their tails, which is kind of creepy. If you pick one up, they sometimes will do that.
And you have them in your eye. Fortunately, I don't have them in my yard yet.
Yay! Celebrate the victory while you've got it.
I don't think any of the neighbors have, at least my nearby neighbors that I know of, and I haven't heard about anything in our little neighborhood. But once they get in there, they can really raise some heck. And
yeah, I started seeing some plants dying this year. And I've seen actually lawns. I've seen some problems in lawns. Now, they only like kind of moist, cool soils. So if you've got hot, dry areas that have a lot of roots, you're probably not going to see a lot of worms there. But shaded areas in particular, they really like.
Cindy in Verona had sent us an email and wondered if you can get rid of jumping worms by burning your garden prairie fire style, you know, will the heat kill them and so forth?
Well, if they happen to be in the very upper layer at the time of the burn, it's certainly possible you could get rid of a few, but it's not likely that it would kill the cocoons that are farther down in the soil. And they do actually, even though they're an epigeous species, which means that they're more in the upper part
right.
of the soil, they do go down farther than we thought they would.
So they can survive.
They can
the
get
winter.
Away. Yep. Yeah. Well, no, because they survive the winter
as cocoons,
right? The adults die off. I tend to see more at this time of year than any other time of year because the leaves are starting to fall down and they like to hang out in that kind of environment. And they're at their biggest and wiggliest at this time of year, too. So.
And getting rid of, and you have a sort of a little system that you use to at least cut back the numbers.
Yeah, I'm kind of fighting a holding action. There is a product called Early Bird that is an organic fertilizer that has tea seed meal in it. And that, the saponins in that will irritate the worm's membranes and they come up to the surface and then they desiccate and die. But you have to water it in. And the thing is, we're not recommending it wholesale extension recommendation. We're recommending it for experimental use, mm-hmm. and it may work better in some systems than others. It is not labeled for vegetable gardens. And there is another product, biochar, and that you don't need any kind of permission to use. It's great for your vegetable garden. It basically will irritate the worm's membranes again, but you have to incorporate it into the soil, whereas the Early Bird, you just scatter it on top and then you water the heck out of it.
And
you do have to water the heck out of it.
Lisa Johnson, our guest today, she is the Dane County Horticulture Educator for UW Extension. You can join in with your questions. You might have a question about the jumping worms. Maybe you've got another question. We'd certainly love to hear from you. Give a call at 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. Love to hear from you. Actually, Geraldine in Williams Bay is with us, so let's go to Geraldine. Thank you for calling.
Thank you. Good morning.
Morning.
I am looking for a book that I have previously purchased from the Master Gardeners. Four or five books that I have. It's a yearly calendar garden book. Every month it has different tips what you should do that month, that week of the month. It's so helpful. And suddenly I cannot find a source for this Master Gardener gardening Wisconsin book, and I wondered if you could help me.
Well, they have actually stopped producing that book. They stopped in, I think, 2013 or 14. So that's why you're having issues finding it. Sorry about that.
Oh, that's too bad. Do you know of another book along those lines?
Yeah.
I was trying to.
I think probably Melinda Myers has something that is similar. I write a weekly column in the Wisconsin State Journal that gives you some tips in terms of what you're supposed to do at this time of year, and I let people know if there are new diseases like boxwood blight and sudden oak death, etc. But it isn't pretty. It doesn't have pretty pictures in it, I'm afraid.
I think Melinda Myers has something like that.
Yeah, I almost think she do like a seasonal advice or tips or something like that.
Yeah, Geraldine, if you went to her website, you might be able to find that. Melinda Myers.
Mm-hmm. And you can certainly still use the old books.
Yeah.
The advice is still valid. You just need to figure out the different dates.
Yeah, there we go. Thank you so much for that call. Appreciate it. Let's go to Robin in Superior. Hi, Robin.
Hello.
What can we do for you?
I have a couple of red twig dogwood that I have in my front yard. It's mostly an east facing. The leaves keep kind of curling in on themselves in the summer. The only insects that I've seen on there are little tiny ants.
Okay.
But it's just never getting very full, and the leaves always look a little sickly.
Mm-hmm.
That's my first question. And then the second one is they're getting way too tall. So I'm wondering how far back to trim them and when the best time to do that is.
Okay. So let me ask you a couple questions about the environment that this plant is growing in. I see you're in Superior, so you've probably got kind of rocky soil. Is that right? Or
Where I'm at, it's a lot of clay.
Okay. All right. And is this in full sun or partial shade?
It's in full sun in the morning.
Okay.
And of course, depending on the time of the year, but about a half a day, probably a half a day of sun and then in shade the rest of the time.
The reason that I asked is when you tell me you're seeing a symptom like the leaves curling in on themselves, sometimes that's a symptom of the plant not getting enough water. So I was wondering if you were in rocky soil and in full sun, but it sounds like you're in clay. I should tell you also that red twig dogwoods are kind of a foliar disease magnet. They do tend to get a lot of foliar spot diseases. And dogwoods in general tend to get canker diseases as well. So it is a good idea to prune them on a regular basis. The more actively growing, vigorous young material that you have, the more able they are to resist those sorts of diseases. So we usually recommend cutting them back. You use a pruning technique that's called renewal pruning or thinning. I learned it under renewal pruning, but I think they now call it thinning. And what you do is you take a third of the biggest, oldest canes out right at the base, and then for the rest of the plant, you shape it to whatever size and shape you're looking for. So you can be pretty brutal with them, but you need to do it after they have gone dormant. So you could either do it in, like, December. Well, you could technically do it, you know, January or February, but I don't like to make pruning wounds when it's really cold out because sometimes you get cracking. So I would do it in, let's see, you're in Superior, so you probably have snow into April.
You know, it could be June sometime.
Oh, geez. So anyway, down south here, I would say do it sometime in March, but you probably could get away with April as long as the air temperature is less than 50 degrees and you haven't seen any growth on the plant, you can cut it back at that time. And if you do see any sunken, discolored areas in the bark, that could be canker. So if you did see that, I would disinfect your pruning shears with rubbing alcohol in between cuts if you see that. If you don't see any of that, then just disinfect them in between plants.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm not sure what the ant deal is. Sometimes we see ants on plants that have aphids that are causing sooty mold, which is a kind of a black mold that grows on top of the leaf. And it grows because of the sugar source that the ants are, the aphids are excreting as they feed. And then the ants tend to mine those aphids, or they tend the aphids and collect that sugary stuff. So that could be what's going on, unless you happen to see an anthill in the direct area.
Hmm. There you go, Robin. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate your call. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, Nigel O'Shea, our engineer, Cheryl Gasser, our on-air producer. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. If you have a gardening question, I hope you'll join in today. Larry Mueller for Garden Talk, our guest today, Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Always great to have her come by. A couple of lines open, or three lines open at 1-800-642-1234. So give us a call. We'll get you on pretty quickly. Or if you want to email us, do that at ideas@wpr.org. Let's go to Lynn in Rhinelander. Hi, Lynn. Thank you for calling.
Oh, thanks for taking my call. Lisa, what are the limits of cold for these jumping rooms? I live north of Rhinelander, and we had 340-degree blow nights last winter. So what can they go through? What kills them?
That is a really good question. Since they overwinter as cocoons, they're pretty well protected. Especially if you've got snow cover, I don't think that you're probably going to be able to get rid of them. There is a map on the, on one of the DNR sites. I think if you just go to Wisconsin DNR and put jumping worms in the search box, there should be a map of where they are in the state. And they are pretty far up there. And if they are able to survive up in New Hampshire, probably, unfortunately, they're going to be able to survive here.
Have you seen them, Lynn, in Rhinelander?
No. I just know that the local nurseries don't recycle their pots anymore, which is really a disadvantage for us gardeners because of they're worried about that. But it's just that we had my septic and my water froze those 3 days.
Wow.
I mean, we're talking about going down 2 feet.
Wow. Well,
if they would survive.
Yeah, it's a really good question. There is some research going on. There is a lot that we just don't know at this point.
I'm guessing you would have killed a few of them.
I would certainly think you would have killed a few of them if it went down 2 feet.
I'm curious.
Yeah.
Well, thank you.
Yeah.
Thanks a lot for calling. Appreciate it. And, we should just talk a bit more about somebody like Lynn who doesn't have them yet, when you're...
Some things you can do?
Yeah, some things to keep them out.
Yeah, right, exactly. So, unfortunately, plant sales tend to be one of the ways that they get spread because people may not know that they have them in their garden, and so you can spread them that way. Compost, they can travel in compost. Now, we do have some... commercial composters in the state, they're required to follow some DNR guidelines about how many times they have to turn the pile and how hot it has to get and how long it has to stay there. And so if you're going to buy compost, I would get it from a commercial supplier. I have them in my compost bin. They are quite happy in there, and they're helping to recycle my kitchen waste. But wow.
Yeah.
But those are some things to think about. Also, not collecting leaves from the curb because they do travel in leaves as well.
So a couple things to think about there, Lynn. Thank you so much for calling. Lee in Green Bay will go to you next. Hi, Lee.
Oh, yeah, good morning. I would like to ask Lisa, with the loss of our American elms, the oak wilt, now with our ashes, is there anything in the way of diseases or insects that will be attacking our linden family, like the little leaf linden, the American linden, et cetera?
Well, we have Japanese beetles that really like to feed on. Yeah, they really like to feed on linden trees. They will start at the top. So usually about halfway through the summer, if you've got Japanese beetles, you'll see that the top third of your tree is denuded. We also have linden borers, and I think those are native. We do tend to see more problems with them in our urban forest, in our street trees, because they tend to be under more stress than in a forest situation. Now, I'm not sure whether there's any difference in the Japanese beetle feeding habits between the European linden, which they really like, that's the little leaf linden, and our native basswood. I'm not sure whether there's a differential there or not. I suspect probably not much.
No.
But those are the two main things that I think about with lindens. I'm sure Brian Huddleston or PJ Leash could give you more. Brian's motto is always, show me a plant and I'll show you a disease. And I'm sure that the same is true for insects.
You might even check the insect or the plant disease diagnostic clinic Brian usually has if there's a bulletin or a fact sheet.
Yeah.
He would have it on his website, which is, if you just type in, what is it, UW-Madison Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic.
Yeah, or just PDDC. That'll usually get you there.
Yeah, there you go, Lee. Thank you so much for calling. Appreciate it. And on to Joanne in Shell Lake.
Hi, thanks for taking my call.
Sure.
I had an abundance of apples this year on my one apple tree. I got 7 5-gallon pails of apples.
Good Lord.
Okay, what happened was about a two-inch in diameter branch that I kept propping up with 2x4s because it was so heavy finally broke.
Mm.
And so it split. And so in order to save, I think, the rest of the tree, I'm going to cut that branch off.
Yeah, that's the thing to do.
Yeah. And do I have to seal that cut with something?
Actually, we don't recommend using sealants like tar or anything like that. The research has shown that it tends to keep more diseases in than keep diseases out. There is just two exceptions to that. If you have to cut oaks or elms during the growing season, you do use a product like that simply to keep the insects that carry oak wilt and Dutch elm disease out. But with apples, it's best to prune when they're in the dormant season, or if you can't because you need to deal with that wound, at least when it's dry out. So I wouldn't go out today when it's raining. Well, I don't know what it's doing in Shell Lake, but it's raining here. So try and do that when it's dry. We do have a nice fact sheet at Brian Huddleston's website that's called How to Prune Deciduous Trees, and it has some diagrams so that you make sure that you don't cut too far back into that branch. Now, what you should do in the future is make sure that you do some thinning so that your apples don't actually bear so heavily on that one branch or any one branch.
Yeah, and I think even some of that's on that fact sheet.
Yeah.
I think talking about how to cut the crossed limbs that are crossing over and things
right.
of that nature.
Right. Actually, that would be in the training and pruning apple trees, and that's at our learning store site. Yeah, you may want to look at that. That one's got some really nice diagrams as well. And there's also growing apples in Wisconsin. Now, the website for the learning store has changed. It's now learningstore.extension.wisc.edu.
But I bet if you put in UW Learning Store.
Yeah, I bet it would get there.
In fact, I know from experience.
It'll get there.
That it'll get there. Joanne, does that help?
Yes, that helps a lot.
All right.
Okay, thank you.
Thanks very much for calling. And Carl in Black River Falls, on to you now.
Yes, I love catalpa trees.
They're pretty cool.
I've never planted a catalpa seed. I planted a tree when my boy was 2 or 3, and he's 40 now, and that tree towers into the sky. Anyway, how do you go about planting a catalpa seed? The tree provides these long beans,
right?
And they're full of some kind of seed. But
yep.
when do you pick them? Do you pick them up in the fall, in the spring, break them open? What's the procedure on that?
That's a really good question. I don't have the answer at the top of my head. I do have a really cool book in my office by Professor Michael Durr that has propagation techniques for all kinds of woody plants. Now, I would assume that the way the plant is set up, that when the pods are ripe and split or turn brown, that you can collect those seeds. They probably are going to need some kind of cold period. You may be able to plant them right away. I just don't know off the top of my head what the treatment is for those type of seeds. But if you want to give me a call or an email at my office, you can find me online at Dane County Extension, and I can look that up for you. Or maybe we can have Cheryl look it up in the meantime.
That Michael Durr book is...
an awesome book. It tells you, like, if you want to propagate by cuttings, when to take the cuttings, whether they're softwood or hardwood, whether they need any kind of rooting hormone, and if so, what concentration. And it's just an amazing book.
Yeah, and his last name is spelled...
D-I-R-R.
Yeah, I always misspell it. It's Michael... Michael D-I-R-R.
Yes.
Michael Durr.
And you probably could get that book, I would assume, on Amazon, probably used.
Oh, yeah.
I think it's called, like, The Propagation Manual of Woody Plants or something like that.
And it's been out a long time, but
it has.
But
yeah. Yeah, right? it's really good, and I think there are new, I think there's a new edition.
All right, there you go, Carl. Thank you so much. Appreciate it. Lupe in Milwaukee, it's your turn. Hi.
Hi. I have a question.
Okay.
Has to do with my viburnum.
Okay.
Viburnum opulus, I believe. It's a beautiful, I don't know if it's considered a shrub or a small tree, but it's about maybe 9 to 10 feet tall. It has gives me pleasure for 3 seasons, the blooming, then the berries, and then in the fall, it has beautiful foliage. Now, it was infected this spring. By the time I noticed the leaves look like lace. And then I took one, I inspected it underneath, and there are tiny little black, well, for the lack of a better word, I'm going to call them worms, but they look like furry little worms, and then it was totally devastated. I saw maybe 1 or 2 flowers, a little cluster of flowers, no berries at all this summer, and then I thought it came back, but then it started all over again, and then now there are just a few leaves left. I want to know if I can still save it this year or wait for the spring. I've done a little research on the computer, but I want to speak with someone, with an expert like you.
Hmm.
So I think what you have is, unfortunately, a new beetle that's in our area called viburnum leaf beetle. And the larva, which would be the worms that you're referring to, are fairly small, and they feed on the leaves and do cause that skeletonizing, lacy kind of look. I am suspecting that because you're in the Milwaukee area, and we know that we have some infestations of them there. Unfortunately, we don't have really good controls for this. In fact, they're suggesting not growing European cranberry bush viburnum, which is Viburnum opulus, or arrowwood viburnum. There's a bunch of other ones. If you go to the PDDC site, that's the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site, if you just put PDDC in your search browser, you can look at a fact sheet for the viburnum leaf beetle. And there are some insecticides that you can use, but it's really challenging because they're quite mobile. There are some systemic products that you can apply to the soil, like imidacloprid, but these should be applied after flowering because you don't want to risk any damage to any pollinators. Now, you said yours wasn't flowering, so that may not be an issue. The other thing is that they will start to lay eggs. So there's a really good picture at the fact sheet at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site that you can see the little raised egg masses, and those should be pruned off. So they like to put them on the new growth where it's most tender, and so you should examine those twigs and try and destroy those. Sorry about the bad news.
Yeah, sorry, Lupe, but go to that PDDC site and you'll get some more information as well from there. Thank you so much for calling.
You're welcome. Thank you.
Yeah. Chuck in Viroqua had emailed. He had a straw bale garden this summer and recently seeded about 3,000 square feet of his lawn. Wonders, he's got the spent bales from the growing season. But he has some concerns because the tomatoes grown from the bales ended up in poor conditions, ended up with large black areas. I'm not quite sure what that means. Would using the straw spread the virus bacteria over the whole seeded area? He doesn't plan to have a garden in that seeded area next summer or perhaps ever.
Yeah.
I wouldn't do it.
I would not do it myself. Because you can have spores if it's a fungal pathogen. If it's a bacterial pathogen, you could have those actually in the straw bale. So unless you hot compost, I would not use that straw
no.
for anything. And preferably even just get rid
get
of it.
Get rid of it, yeah.
Get it
now,
off your site.
Now, if you had healthy straw, I mean...
healthy straw, that would be awesome. That would be a great thing to do.
Mark in Bailey's Harbor, it's your turn. Hi, Mark.
Hi, how are you?
Good, appreciate the call.
Yeah, I have a question about roses. Every year, I have roses at my house, and every year I get these tiny little green worms that eat all the leaves until there's nothing but skeleton of the leaves. I get lots of flowers, but I can't seem to get rid of the worms.
Hmm.
I tried something from the nursery. They didn't actually know what the worms were. They gave me something which was very expensive, and you're supposed to spray the leaves, the under part of the leaves and everything. And I end up every year having to go through the roses and pick all the worms off. But in short amount of time, there's more. So,
are they eating the rose buds or just the leaves?
Just the leaves.
Just the leaves. Okay. Well, then it probably isn't the rosebud worm, is my guess. There are a number of worms that are not worms, but caterpillars that fit that description. So I'm not exactly sure which one it is. What I would do is next spring, when you see those, if you can take a digital picture with your phone and send it to PJ Leash at the Insect Diagnostic Clinic, he can identify what species it is and give you some better advice, because whatever was recommended by the nursery, you know, if you don't know what the culprit is,
you're taking a guess,
and sometimes the guess doesn't work very well. And I'm really hesitant to apply insecticides to something like roses that pollinators really like, too. So you don't probably want to use a systemic product either, although those typically aren't transmitted into the flowers very well, but, you know, it's still a risk. But I think PJ would be your best bet for getting a good ID.
So the UW Insect Diagnostic Lab.
Right.
Make a note of that, Mark. And if you have some photos now, you may have some.
Yeah.
You need a close-up, though.
A good quality one that isn't real blurry.
Right.
Okay. Now, I can tell you that these are, I don't call these caterpillars. I call them worms because they're small. They're only about a quarter to maybe a half inch long. And they're more of a smooth, and they're kind of a lime green colored.
Okay. They're not shiny and black. Because there is a rose slug sawfly that usually feeds underneath the leaves and can cause some of that skeletonizing, but they don't eat the whole leaf.
Yeah. So you need to get that identified.
Yeah. I'm not sure exactly what species that would
be. Yeah. So Insect Diagnostic Lab and get some good close-up photos, clear photos.
Okay.
All right. Thanks, Mark. Appreciate it. Peter in Washburn, your turn. Hi, Peter.
Hi. I have a question about apple trees. First, the location was probably planted as a pine plantation decades ago and just left nature, but there are five apple trees randomly growing around it. One of them, it appears to me, produces two distinctly different apples, one that's yellow, a little bit soft with some red streaks. The other one is harder, really white flesh with red in the flesh underneath the bright red skin.
Yep.
And the tree itself, it's all one trunk right at the bottom, but within about a foot, it's obviously three distinct trunks that kind of wrap themselves. In fact, there was a fourth, but they kind of squeezed it out. And I'm wondering, is it possible that actually was just a seed, an apple that seeded itself four times, and then came up with the different types of apples?
Well, it's possible, but I think it's much more likely that it is an apple tree that has several different kinds of apples grafted onto it. I remember when I was growing up, I would see that quite commonly in the Sunday paper that they would offer apple trees with five different kinds of apples on them.
Yeah.
So especially if this is an older tree, I would not at all be surprised. And it's not uncommon. You can still find those today. What they try and do is pick apple cultivars that will pollinate each other so that you don't need to have two trees, that you can do it with just one. And so that means they have to flower at the same time and hopefully ripen more or less at the same time, although that's not needed for pollination. They just need to have compatible pollen and flower at the same time. So I suspect that's what's going on.
Yeah, there you go, Peter. Thank you so much.
Well, it is really old. The trunk, as it leaves the ground, is about a foot across.
Wow.
Yeah.
Oh, nice.
Yeah, that's a big one. Thanks, Peter. Thank you very much for calling. Lisa Johnson, our guest today, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. I'm Larry Mueller for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. You're listening to Garden Talk on the Ideas Network. Larry Mueller with my guest Lisa Johnson, UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. Join in with your questions at 1-800-642-1234 or email us at ideas@wpr.org. Terry in Lancaster has something for us, so let's go there. Hi, Terry.
Hello. Hello. Got a question on our raised garden beds this year. Tried them our first time, and I loved the height. The root plants grew real well, radishes, carrots, like that. Cucumbers, zucchini did not do well at all. And I don't know, we watered religiously, and we used peat moss compost and a garden soil mixture, a third of everything. And I don't know. Any suggestions on what to do there and what to do with them in the winter? Do we cover them with plastic or what?
Okay. So good news is you don't have to cover them with plastic. So that's a nice mm-hmm. nice benefit. Just in spring, be sure to go in with your shovel and kind of ruffle up the soil if it's packed down over winter. Sounds like you used a good soil mix. I do like to use some of the bagged products myself, and I augment that with a little bit of composted manure. I love growing in raised beds. Unfortunately, my jumping worms also like my raised beds. I'm not sure what the problem was with your cucumbers. Did you plant them from seed or did you plant them from transplants?
No, it was a plant like at a...
Like at a garden center?
Garden store.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm. What happened to them that they didn't do well? Can you tell me a little bit about that?
Did they grow? Were they really healthy?
Well, they started out as healthy, but then only got two little 4 or 5 inch pieces of odd shaped fruit on it. That was it. And the zucchini never did really take off at all. And
did the leaves grow well?
Yeah, for a while, and then they just kind of withered away, I guess, at the end, towards the end of the season when everybody else's were doing. We even put a couple of tomato plants in there, too, and they didn't do real well either.
There is some evidence that cucurbits can have some not-so-good effect on other crops, so... That might be what the problem was with the tomatoes. Were these all in the same bed or were they in different beds?
Cucumbers was separate,
okay.
A 4x4 or 6x6, whatever it was. And then, but the zucchini I had on one side of it and two tomato plants on the other, or three.
Okay.
Yeah, way down.
Yeah. When you said they withered away, I kind of wondered if there was maybe some downy mildew or cucumber mosaic or something like that going on. Also, did you plant more than one cucumber plant because the pollination you...
Yeah.
Probably.
Yeah, we typically put a flat in there. And,
okay.
Yeah,
wow.
I probably had four.
Okay. That should be plenty.
In a bunch. Yeah, right in the middle I put. I thought it would be, I envisioned it vining way over because it's 4 feet or 3.5 feet high. It's awesome to work on.
Yeah, I bet.
Right there and...
Huh. It sounds like you did everything right.
I'm with you on the maybe cucumber mosaic or something
like that. I mean, because that doesn't always look, it's kind of nebulous symptoms.
Yeah.
It doesn't always look like there's something really wrong with it. But when you're talking about stunting like that, I tend to think that there is something not quite right with the plant material. Did you fertilize at all?
A couple of times we put Miracle-Gro. Yeah. That's about it.
Sounds like you did everything right. I would try again next year in a different
bed,
just in case
sure.
There's some kind of root problem or, you know, anything that might have gotten into the soil.
And you could plant some other things there that did well.
Yeah, in a different plant family.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yep. There you go, Terry. Sorry, we...
Yeah, couldn't solve that one for you.
Answer for you, but there you go. Shirley in Nakusa, what's on your mind?
Well, yeah, I got some apple trees back here, and they did produce me, the one produced me probably 8 or 9 apples, and the other one maybe about 3 or 4. I want to know, when do we prune those apple trees, and what else can I do so that they would do better for next year?
Are these... old established trees, or are they younger trees?
Yeah.
Okay.
No, they're really established.
Okay.
And you've had good yields from them in the past?
No.
Okay.
No, this is the first year that the one tree produced me 8 or 9 apples.
Okay.
And the other one produced me about 3 or 4 of them.
So are these trees maybe like 7 years old or so, or are they older?
Oh, all of that are at least 7.
At least 7. Okay. Are they in full sun?
Yes.
Okay. All right.
Maybe right on the tip of things. Oh, I wonder one more year.
Yeah, I was thinking if usually with a standard apple tree, it takes 5 to 7 years for them to really start producing. That's why I was asking about the age of the trees. The other thing I'm thinking is possibly pollination issue. If it was really cold during the time of, our apples here in our teaching garden didn't flower very much because of the cold winter. We actually lost a lot of our buds. The other thing is you may have a variety that is an alternate year bearer where you get really good flowering and fruiting one year and then really lousy flowering and fruiting the next year. And thinning, if during the really well-producing years, will help the tree save energy in order to produce the next year. So that could be going on as well. Do the trees bloom at the same time?
Yeah, pretty frequently. Yeah.
Okay, all right. Well, that all sounds good. my guess is pollination or the alternate year bearing, possibly
some
cold
combination.
Winter. Yeah, it could be that. You should, when you prune them, you should prune them during the dormant season, and you try and clear a lot of stuff out of the middle in order to get windows of light penetration that will help to get better bearing. And we have a really nice publication at the Learning Store that's called Training and Pruning Apple Trees, and we also have one that's called Growing Apples in Wisconsin that I think would be great.
Yeah, so the UW Learning Store.
Yeah, if you just Google the UW Learning Store.
It'll pop up. Shirley, thank you very much for calling. Dennis in Baldwin has something for us. Hi, Dennis.
Yeah, good morning. I got a walnut tree that's had a really bumper crop of walnuts this year. And I've seen before that in my flower gardens and everything.
Uh-oh.
Oh!
Dennis?
I think we lost Dennis. He was wondering, I can see some notes here on our screen, that he was wondering if you could use fallen nuts from an existing tree to grow more walnut trees.
Yes, you absolutely can. Cleaning them is a bear, and you get black stuff all over your hands.
Yeah.
There are actually, we used to have a publication on growing nut trees, but I think that was taken off the Learning Store. It's kind of an involved process. I looked into it once, and I'm trying to remember what all the different steps were, but you had to clean the husk off, and I think you had to store them for a certain amount of time, and they probably needed a cold period. But yeah, those nuts absolutely will grow you new walnuts.
Lisa in Amberg, hello.
Hi, I have an apple tree question related to the one you just answered with the younger trees. I have an old established tree. It's probably 8 or 10 inches in diameter. And we've been there 5 years, and I've got maybe a dozen apples off of it. It's in full sun. It's next to a crab apple, and I don't know whether to cut the darn thing down or or if there's anything else I can do for it. Also, it does have quite a bit of dieback. I didn't know, and I've not pruned it heavily.
Okay.
So,
yeah, dieback kind of worries me a little bit. There are a number of diseases. There's a particularly bad bacterial one that is called fire blight, that the leaves kind of turn black and hang on to the tree instead of falling, and then the branch eventually dies back, and you tend to have sunken areas in the bark that have kind of a amber, resiny sort of look. It's a bacterial exudate, actually, and that's how it's spread by insects usually.
And if you've got
if you've got that, then your tree is not long for this world, I fear. And you might if it was that, I'd be worried about my crab apple being quite so close as well. But there are plenty of other, unfortunately, apple diseases that are less lethal that can cause dieback. You certainly do want to prune off any dead limbs. I see here in the notes that your apple trees are about 30 years old.
Yeah, give or take.
Okay.
Yeah.
Well, I think that's also part of the problem.
Yeah.
Their useful life is usually between 15 and 20 years. So you're probably kind of living on borrowed time there. And they just tend to not get very fruitful as they get older like that. So you may want to just
start
cut
over
your losses and start over with a different tree.
Yeah,
yeah. No pun intended.
There you go, Lisa. Thank you so much for calling.
I have a note about the black
walnut. Oh, yes.
Okay, I lived in Tennessee, and we had lots of black walnuts. And what we did, we would just put them in a box, a cardboard box, and let them completely dry out. And we'd pour them on the driveway and drive over them, and it would clean them.
Oh, wow. I have heard about that, actually.
Oh,
that's an interesting way to do it.
Lisa, thank you very much for calling from Amberg. Appreciate it very much. Well, Lisa Johnson is our guest today, a UW Extension horticulture educator for Dane County. Always great to have her with us for Garden Talk here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller. Lisa Johnson singing there for us, and here she is in person with me in the studio for this edition of Garden Talk. I'm Larry Mueller. Thanks so much for joining us today, taking a look at a whole variety of things here on Garden Talk today. A question for her, I hope you'll give us a call. The number is 1-800-642-1234, or you can email us at ideas@wpr.org. And lots of emails, Lisa. We had Marilyn emailing. She had a severe problem with squash beetles this past growing season. Killed off her zucchini and pumpkins. She's read they survive over winter. What are her organic options for getting rid of these pests? Squash beetles.
Yeah, the squash bug is actually a true bug. So it has a life cycle that has nymphs, which have several molts. Those are they start out kind of small and black, and then they get kind of larger and jade green colored. And then the adult is black. It looks pretty much the size and shape of a box elder bug, but it's all black. And they can build up to quite severe numbers. Now, I'm assuming that she's talking about that rather than the squash vine borer, because the adult
right.
on that is a clearwing moth. So I'm assuming she's talking about the squash bug. Now, they do overwinter as adults, and they overwinter in the plant debris. So doing a real good garden cleanup can help to reduce the numbers, also rotating your crops so that you don't grow your zucchini, pumpkins, cucumbers, any of those sorts of things, cucurbits in the same area every year. So yes, they do overwinter as adults, and then they come forth in the spring and lay eggs, and there you go. Usually when the plants are flowering, you should start implementing controls if you see more than one egg mass per plant. Now, part of the management protocol is to check the lower leaf surface, and usually I'm not sure where you're from, Marilyn.
Let's see here. It doesn't say.
Okay. Well, usually you're going to see the eggs start in my part of the state in late June or so. So start flipping over the leaves, and you'll see these little clusters of kind of copper-colored eggs. And then those should be squished. If you do that, that's a really good organic option to get rid of the problem before it starts. But if you've got a lot of zucchini and pumpkins, it's really hard to keep up with that. So you may need to do some of that, and also making sure, again, cleaning up well in the fall. If you need to use insecticides, pyrethroids like permethrin are recommended, but there has been some resistance that's been developing in the squash bugs. So we're hoping that you don't need to use that. The other thing that you can do is earlier in the year, you can use floating row cover. But if you end up trapping any of these adults underneath the floating row cover, then you've kind of defeated your purpose. But as soon as they start flowering, then you need to take that off in order to have pollination occur. So they are unfortunately really difficult to control. Yeah. If you go to the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic site, there is a nice fact sheet on them then.
Couple of listeners emailed to ask where you can find the early bird fertilizer to treat jumping worms. They've tried to find a source for it online.
Yeah. It's really difficult to find for some reason. The manufacturer is Oceans Organics, and they are in Texas, I believe. There is only one distributor in the state of Wisconsin, which is DHD Turf and Tree in Juneau, I believe. In Madison, there is one retailer, Paradigm Gardens, that sells it. But those are the only places I'm aware of in the state. There may be some other retailers. I had heard that Old Brick Gardens had bought some. They probably got theirs from DHD, but DHD is wholesale. So you probably would need to encourage one of your local businesses to buy from DHD so that they could carry it retail for you.
Terry and Robert shared a picture of her lilacs in bloom right now near Hudson and wants to know what the heck's up with that. Why are they blooming so late?
Yeah, that's quite the picture there, Terry. I would say that whatever the requirements are for dormancy, that they have been met already. My guess is that you had kind of a cool summer near Hudson. When we have cool summers and a lot of rain, sometimes we will get lilacs thinking that, hey, we've already gone through winter and it's time to bloom because it's spring. And they're mistaken about that. So that's, I suspect, what's going on, unless those lilacs are one of the re-blooming cultivars. There are some so-called ever-blooming cultivars, but it doesn't look like that. It looks like just a regular French lilac to me. Yeah. It also looks like, now maybe you've had a lot of leaf drop already, but you may want to do some pruning this year.
Right at the base.
Yeah, yeah. You thin at the base. You take out a third of the biggest, oldest stems, and then you do some clipping around that in order to shape it. But basically, you're trying to make room for new canes to develop or new stems to develop. Now, if you prune it at this time of year, you're going to prune off your flower buds for next year, although it looks like a lot of them have pruned themselves effectively. But yeah, the best time to prune lilacs if you don't want to sacrifice your flower show is right after they bloom in spring. Within about 2 to 3 weeks of finishing bloom, they start to initiate buds for next year. So you need to get right on it after they bloom. Now, if you don't care about sacrificing some blooms, then certainly you can
go
do it
right
during
ahead.
The dormant season is a good time to do it too, because then you can better see what the structure of your plant is.
Let's take a call here. Alex in Madison has something for us. Hi, Alex.
Hi, Larry. first-time caller, long-time listener.
Ah, cool. Thanks for calling.
Hey, we're doing a job over here at Central Wisconsin Center at the Mendota Health Facility. I got 51 plants I'm putting into the ground today.
Woo-hoo!
Even the weather's not in our favor.
No.
I was just wondering if you're thinking they're going to make it through the weekend. Anything from dwarf bush honeysuckles, peewee oak leaf, goldfinger poinsettias, a variety of hostas, some blue catmint. Is there anything else I can do to make them get through the weekend?
So you're saying you're not going to be able to plant them, or you are going to be able to plant them?
I am planting. I'm currently on my lunch break right now.
Okay.
Well, good for you. I spent many years in the industry planting things in less than ideal weather. It is fine to plant anything like that now. I would say if it was an evergreen, I might be a little bit worried about it, but hostas are very tough. Catmint is very tough. As long as you get them into the ground before it freezes, I think we've still got quite a bit of life left in the season, and they should be fine. If they're really small plants, the perennials, you may want to mulch a little bit more heavily to make sure that they don't heave out of the ground. But other than that, those particular types of plants that you've described should be okay, as long as, you know, you get them in, you water them in, and get a little mulch around them. They should be good.
So finish that sandwich and pick up the spade.
Back
and have
at
it. Alex, thank you very much for calling. All right, Jeff in West Salem. Hello.
Yes, hello. I have a question about the late blight this year. It was pretty devastating in our area, I know. And I grew my tomatoes in straw bales again this year. And 1 week they were fine, and the next week everything was pretty much gone.
That was in
August even.
That's really disappointing.
And I was wondering, you know, especially in straw bales, I mean, I shouldn't have probably gotten blight. So I'm wondering, you know, they say it's a soil-borne fungus, but is it possible it's just in the air?
Actually, early blight is soil-borne. Late blight is airborne. It can also come in on tomato transplants. But, yeah, we tend to have more of it when we have storms that bring in those spores. About the only way that you can guard against it, first of all, get rid of any, you know, material. Get that out of your garden. Don't compost it. Put it in bags and put it in your garbage. But there are some resistant varieties that I would recommend. We have, I believe it's on the fact sheet. There are on the late blight fact sheet that's at the PDDC website. There are on the back of the sheet a list of, I couldn't remember what they all were, but Defiant, Mountain Magic, Mountain Merit, Lemon Drop. There's a bunch of them, Iron Lady, that are recommended as late blight resistant. Dispose of any volunteer tomato plants or potato plants that come up. It really is, I mean, some years we have awful problems with it, some years not so much. So that's about the best advice that I can give you. You can proactively use fungicides, but I really hate to recommend using fungicides on edible crops.
Right. So there you go, Jeff. Thank you very much for calling. Appreciate your call. Want to turn to Pat next in Kewaunee. Hi, Pat.
Hello.
How can we help you?
Well, I moved to Wisconsin from Northern California, and in that process, I brought some irises and some magnolia tree seeds hitched a ride, and they're growing. And I repotted them. They're now about 2 feet tall. My question is, can I actually put them in the ground?
Well, you can, but my guess is they probably won't survive our winters. When you have plants that have been grown in a warmer part of the country, and they have genetics that are, we call it provenance, when they've been grown in a situation like that and that seed source is from there, likely they won't survive our winter, but you can certainly give it a shot.
Yeah.
Do you know what kind of magnolia it is?
No, all I know, they're not the giant magnolias. They get, 15, not over 20 feet. They're not even 20 feet. They're 10, 15. So they're a smaller breed.
Pink flowers, white flowers?
White.
Oh, okay.
And they're white, very fragrant.
Okay.
They're a nice tree. I was just surprised that all of a sudden I saw them growing. I was like, where did you come from? And
yeah. Yeah. So there are, there's magnolia, now I'm forgetting the species name, but some of the white ones tend to be shorter growing, and they tend to flower a little bit later, so sometimes we don't have the issues that we have with the saucer magnolia. My guess is, again, that the provenance is going to be a problem, but... You know, give it a shot. Why not? Yeah.
Could she stick it in the ground now? Or would she wait till spring?
Well, you've got these trees that you've been growing in pots, right? Have you been growing them outside?
Well, when it's nice weather, I bring them outside. Otherwise, I take them down to the basement, have a light on them. And they've been, in the wintertime, they've been down there, and they're doing fine.
Okay. If they haven't been outside all summer, and particularly now that it's starting to get colder, if they aren't starting to initiate dormancy, I'm not sure they'll go into dormancy very well. Ideally, you would have wanted them to, you know, start to initiate leaf drop and going into dormancy. So I guess I'd continue to
keep them.
Yeah, I'd keep them as a house plant for this winter and then plant them out in spring.
Yeah.
Okay. I know that they tend, I'm thinking of what they look like back home. It was at my parents' place. They did not drop all their leaves.
Oh, okay. If they're an evergreen version, they probably won't. Well, give it a shot.
I'd keep them all winter, though, anyway, for sure, and put them out next spring. There you go, Pat. Thank you so much. Ann in Menominee has something for us.
Hello, this is Ann from Menominee.
Hi, Ann.
Hi. Say, I'm calling because I have some spruce trees. Three of them are sort of together by my garden, and one is further up the hill. And I noticed in a matter of, like, just a few weeks, it had looked fine this spring, and I was mowing lawn up there, and all of a sudden I'm like, well, it was completely brown, and all the needles were falling off. So it just died, like, I have no idea why, just all of a sudden. It was fine in the fall, too. I'm worried about the other three spruce trees that are about 350 feet away because... they are now starting to get yellow needles.
Okay.
I was wondering if you had any idea what it might be, what I could research, and if there's a treatment, too, that won't affect honeybees because we have honeybee hives right next to them.
Okay. First of all, there are a number of needle cast diseases like rhizosphera that, you know, could be affecting the spruce tree that perished. When I see needles yellowing at this time of year, if they're in the middle of the plant, I don't worry about it too much because there's a seasonal needle drop that can occur. But if they're on the outer parts of the plant, then that might be a problem. If you could send a sample in to Brian at the Plant Disease Diagnostic Clinic and get a definitive diagnosis, that would probably be your best bet and course of action to recommend something. If you have large trees, though, it's really hard to treat for fungal diseases because usually you'd have to spray, and that's typically not something that is easy to do. But it could be anything from a canker disease to needle cast disease. Hard to know without seeing a sample.
And if you go to the clinic, go to PDDC, there's descriptions or explanations of how to submit a sample and where and so forth. So it's worth it, and to do, for sure.
Yeah, absolutely. Trees are expensive, so
yep.
The test
yep.
is worth it.
Yeah.
And they are not that big, you know. so they're probably 8 foot tall at the
moment. Oh, okay. So these are younger trees then.
Yep.
All right. Yeah. Well, I would send him a sample with some healthy-looking foliage on the same tree and some not-so-healthy-looking needles and, you know, send him a twig. It'll tell you how to package it and all of that. So I would do that and see if we can figure out what's going on.
And thanks very much for calling. Appreciate it. Helen has an ash tree, 15 years old. The roots are coming through the grass. The tree's healthy. She treats it every 2 years. Wants to know how best to care for the tree and the lawn. It's, you know, those roots are shallow, can be pretty shallow. Almost any tree, the roots are pretty shallow.
Right. Actually, the statistics are that about 90% of the tree's root system is in the top 12 inches. So it's not uncommon to have those roots. I would use mulch, just like I see you're suggesting that in your question. Don't put it any deeper than about 2 to 3 inches and don't have it up against the trunk. But you can bring that out to, 3 or 4 feet out from the trunk, or you could even bring it out to the drip line. And, sometimes trees and lawns just don't coexist together very well. So I think that's a fine idea. And you could even plant some native plants underneath it in the mulch, like wild ginger or bloodroot or any one of a number of different things that could be really beautiful. I'm glad you're treating your ash tree because otherwise I would have recommended taking it out.
Right.
Yeah.
Tom in Heartland, do you have a quick question for us?
Yeah. I transplanted an elm tree a couple of years ago. It was just starting to poke out of the ground. And now it's growing quite good, but the branches are starting to come out at ground level.
Mm-hmm.
And I'm wondering, can I trim those branches off so that when it grows up, we can still walk underneath?
Yes.
Yeah,
you can absolutely. But you want to do it after the tree is dormant because of the danger of Dutch elm disease. So you want to make sure that it's after the tree has shed its leaves for the season.
Yeah, probably December maybe.
Yeah, you could do that or you could wait until March before the buds start to swell.
There is a deadline, I'm forgetting.
It's 50 degrees. You don't want to have it be 50 degrees. And yeah, usually it's April through November. You don't want to prune.
And I have to tell everybody that Limey, my lime tree, has more than 100 blossoms on her right
now. That is just so cool.
Oh, we put a photo up on our show blog. So she's going to produce a lot more limes this coming year. Lisa, it's always a pleasure. Thank you so much.
Well, thank you for asking me.
She is the UW Extension Horticulture Educator for Dane County. And a great singer, too. Looking ahead on Monday, we'll look at how to secure your home, Wi-Fi, and other tech questions. Hope you can join us for that. And in the meantime, thank you so much for listening. And, hey, stay around. There's lots more in store here on the Ideas Network. I'm Larry Mueller.